Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. 530,000 Americans have died during the coronavirus pandemic thus far. As President Biden's $1.9 trillion stimulus package passes the House and Senate and has been signed to law, Biden is urging the nation to continue wearing masks and practice physical distancing until more of the population is vaccinated. At this point, some 2.5 million Americans a day are getting their jabs. This as air travel is surging to 1.4 million passengers going through U.S. airports on Friday alone. Joining us today, as they do every week, is our roundtable, Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London, and Richard Oblafia of the Thiel Group Consultancy here in sunny Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here, Vago. Thanks.
Yeah, as always, Vago, thank you.
Happy Sunday, Vago. Great to be here.
Happy Sunday. Happy Sunday to all. And before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage, Northrop Grumman, our weekly cyber report, and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri, Marinette Marine, our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Ron, give us a sense for the market's head last week, right? I mean, we have the stimulus package going through, record numbers of inoculations going into arms, air travel surging, which has been particularly good for one particularly troubled name in the group that also scored some 737 orders. And then we had the big GECAS, the GE Capital and Aero Capital deal, which was not as good for GE stock overall. Walk us through the week and some of the big things that we saw.
Yeah, so just kind of broadly, you know, as we've been tracking, you know, interest rates are still inching higher. The 10-year is at about 1.63%. And if you look at that in a historical perspective, we're at the levels with yields where they were before the pandemic. And in fact, we're at the level of yields where they were in 2019 and climbing higher. In conversations I've had with investors, there's the 2% level. If the yield were to break through the 2% level, that might alarm some folks. We're not there yet. You might not get there, but that's kind of the next level people are looking at. When you look at the sector, like you said, Boeing was a champ this week. It was up 20% on the week. AerCap was up 19%. But it's interesting. You look at, you know, Embraer was up 14%. So kind of across the group, you had some nice momentum. I guess that's the way I'd describe it in commercial aerospace. Raytheon Technologies was up about 4.5% and GD was up 3.5%. And in a backdrop where the S&P was up about 2.5%. The order activity on 737, I can't say that anybody thought that was a surprise. You know, we got some orders from United. The 777 group, which is a financing group, ordered some aircraft. And it looks like Southwest is going to be ordering some aircraft. None of that should have come to a surprise. I think the big question that investors need to ask themselves that they might not have yet is what price were those airplanes ordered at? And I think that's the ongoing question in this,
right,
market share battle that we've talked about, where Boeing's been losing for the last 2 years. One of the weapons that they can wield in that fight is price. That's I think one of the things that when you start peeling back the onion, you got to understand. But broadly, commercial aerospace had a good week.
And Airbus freighters, how do you think that affects the picture at all?
Well, it's interesting, right? So, you know, the A321 is, I think firmly established itself as a player in that lower end of the middle market, you know, put it that way. And the freight market was really the provenance of Boeing for a very long time. I mean, I think the last successful Airbus freighter, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the A300. So if Airbus were to bring to market a freighter version of the A350, you know, that's firmly picking at a market that's been Boeing's market for a long time. So this is an example of their competitor, Atlantic, potentially doing something clever from a market positioning perspective, an aircraft that they have that seems to be capable to do this in a market that might need the demand. So it's just another potential headwind for Boeing in a market that, you know, in recent history anyways, just been 100% their market.
Sash, talk to us about global air travel trends and vaccinations early in the pandemic. We talked a little bit about PPE diplomacy, personal protective equipment diplomacy, as we saw the United States sort of being accused of America first and outbidding its allies in supplies, causing some bitterness, a void in which China and Russia stepped in to supply product, even though if it was a defective product. Now, there are a couple of news stories suggesting the United States is, you know, Europe taking, that some in Europe are taking exception to the U.S. stockpiling vaccinations. There was a story that talked about 10 million, you know, U.S. sitting on 10 million AstraZeneca doses. As I mentioned at the top of the program on Friday alone, almost 2.5 Americans got their jabs. That rate is rapidly increasing. So this isn't that big of a stockpile if we're going to achieve the kind of vaccination levels that the administration at the end of the day is talking about. Talk to us about the air travel picture from a European perspective and how, you know, is this the EU sort of trying to find a scapegoat at the end of the day for sort of having mismanaged this? Not to put a final point on it.
Nah. Look, from a European point of view, there isn't any air travel. I mean, that's the long and short of it. And actually, if you look at the world as, in a series of very obvious blocks, the US is recovering at the moment very, very well. And you mentioned yourself, probably the best day's traffic in a year in terms of TSA throughput. China has recovered from the very short but very sharp lockdown that they had over the Chinese New Year. And the Chinese air travel is now going at about the same level as the second half of 2020. But in Europe, which is an incredibly important bloc because there's an awful lot of economy there, but also it's the area that a lot of people fly through, is, dead. I mean, I drove past Heathrow twice in the last 2 days and didn't see an airplane take off or land. That is astonishing. Normally, you can see them stacked up in the distance, four, five, six aircraft all coming in at once. There's no air travel in Europe at all. And this is a function of the fact that vaccination rates are incredibly uneven across Europe, but generally very, very low. Now, I'm very fortunate. I'm in the UK. Our vaccination program has gone phenomenally well. We'll be up at about 40% of the population vaccinated in the next few days. Maybe they're already, for all I know. It's been a remarkably unifying thing for all of the four nations in the UK that we've had about, we've done something right for once. Doesn't happen very often, but it's great. The EU has got the vaccination program horribly wrong on so many levels. Basically, the EU tried to go for the cheapest possible vaccines and the cheapest possible deals. They thought it was more important to haggle on price than just to get the damn stuff, and also to make sure they had the production capability. So, UK is a, will be about 40% of the population fairly soon. And the EU is about 6. Some countries are, 8 or 10, but some countries are even lower than that. And that's having a dreadful effect on air travel. Italy has just gone back into lockdown. Absolute, don't even think of getting on a flight to Italy or a flight through Italy. And of course, that has impacts countries in the Middle East and North Africa as well. Germany is trying very hard not to, but might yet. France has got deep problems because their new infection levels are about 5 times what they are in the UK at the moment. And so it's very hard sometimes to, I think if you're in the US, things are going very well. And I totally understand the point you're making about, a lot of people are talking about, it's all over, we can go back and fly now. And US travel, which is predominantly narrow body, is almost certainly going to be first out of the blocks. China is interesting. There's a load factor problem there, but we'll leave that to the Chinese airlines to sort out. Europe is just going to be so long sorting itself out. And then it's going to be the issue of, what sort of flying is allowed and how and why and where. And the EU seems to very much have a view of, if in doubt, ban it, which I think is going to make the recovery from Europe in the second half of the year way slower than everywhere else in the world.
And we saw sort of that awkward moment right last week, which we briefly discussed, where Italy suspended something like 250,000 doses that were being transshipped from the UK to Australia. And impounded those vaccinations because he needed it at home. Thank goodness the Canberra was very understanding and said, look, we have very, very few cases. Go ahead, use it. we can grab a future shipment, because I think there is just handfuls of cases in Oz at the moment.
Just to pick up on a couple of the points that Ron made as well, A350 freighter, I think, is going to be a really interesting test case. There would be a huge amount of data if we hadn't had the most astonishingly bad last 12 months, that the A350 is a very, very good airplane, and its economics beat the 777 hands down. And yet, Ron is absolutely right. Airbus hasn't had a decent freighter since the A300-600, which is a long time ago. It's going to be a very interesting aircraft as well, because it'll be the first time Airbus has tried to make a freighter out of an aircraft which has got a carbon composite fuselage. It should be possible. It should be, in engineering terms, easier than it would be for, say a filament wound 787, because they should be able to cut individual fuselage panels rather than having to worry about effectively rewinding a brand new fuselage. But we'll see. You know, freighters are much harder than people expect to be able to make. But I think it would be a very, very attractive way to support what is currently a very weak A350 line with it. And so, yeah, you know, I think that would be good. I think as far as AerCap and GECAS is concerned, this is going to be a huge, huge leasing company. I'd be astonished if an antitrust authority somewhere doesn't actually raise a yellow card on this one. But I think what this points to is the pressure that Boeing and Airbus are putting on the leasing companies. You remember we talked a couple of weeks ago about the degree to which Airbus had forced leasing companies to take delivery of aircraft for which they couldn't find an end customer. Never, ever seen it at that scale before. And you know, that was very much thin end of the way, or you know, canary in the coal mine stuff. So it's been really tough being a leasing company. And this, you know, this is showing how they react. The people that I'm most interested, the company I'm most interested by in this respect is Rolls-Royce. And why? Because General Electric engines' biggest trump card at every single stage has been to say, take our engine, because we can guarantee that GECAS will go and buy a whole ton of aircraft and then lease them on. And that has given GECAS and hence General Electric a real advantage in the aero engine market that Rolls and Pratt & Whitney have had no way of countering. I think separate GECAS from General Electric Aviation, and that makes General Electric Aviation, the engine company, it brings them down to the same level as everybody else. And I think that's going to be tough. And I think actually that's remarkably good news for Rolls-Royce, albeit on about a 10-year view.
Richard, I want to get your sense on all of that as well, and get your take on all of the stories that we've been seeing recently about business class travel, right? I mean, I think everybody senses that travel is coming back. And so there are all those news stories about, you know, who's got the best amenities. But what I do think is interesting is the stories that are talking about airlines doing stuff differently. For example, JetBlue's Mint all business service, for example, that'll be facilitated by the A321neo, or BA bringing vaccine passports and snacks, right? I mean, I didn't think snacks would be a thing, but okay, snacks are a thing. You know, if you're trapped in the back of the tube and can't even get water anymore. You know, give us your sense on the services we'll see new, as well as anything else you want to comment on the week.
Yeah, you know, I guess 3 points. You know, first about the A350, as everyone said, you know, this is a little bit of an afterthought, and that's a problem when you do a freighter version of a plane. You know, you have to design it from the inset with, you know, freight in mind. Even if a freight version isn't typically launched out of the box, you have to have that requirement in mind. And of course, there was the legendarily not very successful A330-200F, which I think they sold 38 over like 20 years, you know, because frankly, it just wasn't a good design for freight. And Airbus hasn't been, since the A300 at all mindful of freight. You know, the A380, the only large twin aisle ever launched, as if belly cargo didn't exist. You know, just, we forgot. And now you've got the sort of, all right, well, maybe the 350 will be a good freighter, but there's really no way of knowing. And it's unlikely that it was designed from the inset with that in mind. You know, second point about GECAS. Yeah, I agree completely with Sash, but I would take it a step further. It's not just the selection, you know, process against Rolls-Royce. It's the sole source thing. You know, it's the you should use us completely sole source, and this is why. And that, yeah, as exactly as Sash said, basically, this is going, everyone's been focused upon the leasing industry landscape as a consequence of this merger. But really, to me, the story is about what it does to GE. As a matter of fact, somewhere buried on my website, there's the Forbes piece I wrote years ago about why GE, for God's sake, shouldn't sell GECAS. So it's sort of strange to see it not really mentioned as a factor, but I think it certainly is evidence that they're kind of, well, in need of selling everything that isn't nailed down, as a lot of OEMs are. You know, the third thing, of course, is the arrival of new services, you know, the triumph of hope over experience. I mean, maybe it will work out. Maybe the 321 is an enabler here, and it certainly is a great plane for this sort of experimentation and in general. But I also can't help but wonder, and this is something that a lot of what we're talking about has in common, are we in danger as an industry of thinking that the future looks like the present? And I really don't think it does. You know, the drivers in place for the A350 freighter or for new point-to-point business class, ultra-hygienic health passport services, they'll be in place for maybe 6 months. I mean, by the time this stuff gets stood up, it'll all be, gee, what was that for? Oh, how very nostalgic in a painful way. So I can't help but wonder if this is the classic example of the Army fighting the last war here. You know, having said that, yes, I'm looking forward to flying in the latest iteration of a single aisle configured for business class. I just how sustainable that is, I've got my doubts based upon, well, a rather checkered track record.
I find it interesting that one of those stories was like, you know what, flight start at $527. And I was thinking to myself, that's got to be just for a regular JetBlue flight somewhere, right? Unlikely. Right. I mean, the economics of 23 pods on an airplane at $500 each just doesn't sound like it's going to work out. But
yeah. And also you're skimming off the cream from your other routes. Right. Or I mean,
correct.
That's a real problem in terms of your pricing assumptions. And, you know, are you going to have enough where there's a critical mass of people, you know, it's like people said about, you know, Concorde and other supersonic transports, you could put, you know, 30, 40, 50 in service overnight on the New York to London routes of the world. What do you do for an encore? That's a real problem.
I remain a little bit more bullish on the future of supersonic travel than you do. Ron, I know that you want to kind of cover back on all of this, and I know you've got a GE GECAS AerCap point as well.
Yeah, so I think the key point, one of the key points anyway for me on the GECAS AerCap deal is if you look at, you know, the timing of the transaction, you look at how the lessors have been in the current downturn, right? I mean, historically, you'd see the lessors step in and just order just gobs and gobs of airplanes when the market got soft. We haven't seen that in a while. And, you know, one of the reasons for that, I've been told, is that the OEs have been a little more sticky with price on the lessors. You know, when you think about access to capital for the leasing community, they've actually had a surprisingly easy time raising capital during the downturn. And the capital markets writ large have been open, particularly the debt markets. What's interesting, I think, about the timing of this is from my perspective, AerCap buying a portfolio of aircraft from a motivated seller in a buyer's market. Right. So they're getting a nice big portfolio of airplanes from someone who wants to sell it at a time when the value for airplanes is very depressed. So, you know, if we really are on the road to recovery, which seems like a reasonable thing, you know, reasonable estimate, I mean, this could pay off for them hugely because, you know, they're buying aircraft at a good time, kind of doubling down on the cycle and they're not overpaying. Right. So from the AerCap position, you know, I think this is a pretty bullish view on their thinking of where the cycle's going, and B, this is, if you're buying airplanes, this is the time to do it.
Let's shift to flight safety. Anything that you do often, you do well. And one of the reasons the global air safety system was as safe as it was is folks were flying the heck out of their airplanes. You know, we sort of got into a global safety-minded rhythm that was disrupted a bit by the 737 accidents, which were seen as jarring. Accidents will always happen, but there is a concern with so many airplanes parked, so many crews sidelined, and all of a sudden, if we're going to have a surge, how do we get back to this smoothly and safely? This is a topic that some of us have been discussing at conferences and other events and just among ourselves. Ron, why don't you start us off, and then Richard, and then Sash. You know, are there any dangers and challenges here, given that some of these airplanes have been parked for a very long period of time? And as Kevin Michaels, our colleague at Aerodynamics, would say, you know, you park an airplane for too long, it's only about 2 years, and that's the end of that airplane, right? Regarding whether it goes back into service. Obviously, you can part it out. Ron, start us off. Are we going to be able to do this and do this safely? Or do you think there'll be challenges as we come back online, especially if demand comes back as fast as it's coming back?
Yeah, I mean, a couple thoughts. One, I think you have to be careful about the TSA number we just saw because it's spring break, right? So I wouldn't be surprised if that settles back. But if you do assume that air traffic does, you know, kind of surge back, at least domestically, as we work our way through the second half of the year, there's a couple factors that we have to look at. And I think, you know, Richard's mentioned this in the past. You know, when you deal with, you know, things like green time management, serviceable use spare parts, you're juggling things around, you just have to be very careful from a maintenance perspective that the right things are in the right places at the right times and the right parts were put on the right airplanes. I know that sounds maybe kind of ridiculous, but in an environment where, you know, you've been running maybe thinly staffed and you're trying to juggle your rotable parts inventory, could mistakes be made? Sure. Am I going to say that mistakes were made? No. Am I going to say that, you know, there's an impending, threat? No, of course not. But as these aircraft come out of storage and go back into service, it just has to be done, you know, thoughtfully, carefully, and with attention to detail.
Richard?
A complete agreement. You're just increasing the opportunity to make mistakes. There's not necessarily the inevitability of those mistakes. It's just something to watch for. And, you know, people look at aircraft ages as a factor in determining safety. I don't think it has anything to do with it. It has everything to do with process, and you're disrupting that process. So you've got to be mindful when you come back.
Sash?
I totally agree with Richard. You get better at things the more you do them and the more regularly you do them. And we have not been doing them at all regularly. Nobody has been maintaining aircraft regularly apart from the odd freighter, let alone doing, you know, the A, B, and C checks on them. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the good news in all this is there's going to be a ton of spare parts around or pre-used parts around for airlines that need them. It's not as if they're all going to have to go to the OEMs and buy spares at list price and get hosed on it. The number of aircraft that will have been retired, the number of subfleets that will have been retired and in many cases broken up and parted out, means there'll be a lot of surplus material around for those airlines that need them. But the issue, I think, for me is going to be, what comes first? It's a real chicken and egg thing. Is it going to be that passenger demand picks up, or is it going to be that airlines put more aircraft on first? If you look at what's happening in China at the moment, number of flights is up about 50%, but number of passengers is only up about 30%. So they've been putting the flights on a fly it and they will come. It would be the easiest thing if there was a problem with availability or with reliability or whatever, for the airlines just to throttle back a bit on the amount of capacity out there, wait for the passenger demand to get closer to it. And that will buy them some time. I think this is a manageable problem. But we have very, very demanding standards in terms of air safety, certainly in the, you know, in the Northern Hemisphere. And so anything that appears to show a blip up is going to be very newsworthy.
Before we go to the defense part of the conversation, because obviously there's defense-related news here in the United States regarding budget numbers, but also the UK defense review is wrapping up. But I have to really quickly ask you this question about vaccine passports, right? I mean, I should have mentioned, Richard, in my question, right? BA is also saying, hey, you know, what if we do vaccine passports? There are folks who are talking about COVID passports, right? IATA, we've heard from Alex Dejunyak on that it was originally an idea that people wanted to do. And then it was seen as, oh, you know, it's too difficult. Are vaccine passports going to make all the difference at the end of the day when it comes to travel, particularly being able to travel to Europe, for example?
No, vaccine passports don't make the difference at the moment, because what Europe insists on, the EU insists on, actually the UK, is a valid test, a test taken within 2 days of flying. And it will take every individual country to decide that the vaccine passport will trump the recent test requirement for that to happen. So it ultimately will help a lot, although there will then be the issue of whether you need top-ups for your vaccine. And the UK is already planning on a third round of vaccination in the autumn, on the assumption that by that stage, variants will have developed that will be vaccine resistant, and hence that we'll go through a fourth round of the pandemic. So I think the requirement for a test is going to remain more important than the requirement for a vaccine passport.
Richard?
Yeah, what we're in here is a race to rescue the summer of tourism. That's it. Beyond that, it's just not going to matter. There's just, I just don't think this is going to be a factor beyond the third quarter of this year in terms of people's calculation. Now, can you rescue the summer in terms of tourism? Well, I want very much for that to be the case. But on the other hand, echoing Sasha's comments, gee, bureaucracies aren't really great at harmonizing these sorts of things with the matter of months or weeks to deal with. So I'm a little skeptical here.
Ron?
Yeah, I agree with both Sasha and Richard. I mean, it seems like in domestic markets, U.S. domestic, and choose your domestic market, that summer travel might actually be pretty darn good. But when you start dealing with border crossings and bureaucracies, it seems like it's going to be, the summer could be tricky.
Speaking of tricky, the UK government, Sash, walk us through, right? What do we understand about the defense review that's going to be rolled out soon? There's going to be new investment, but there are going to have to be cuts made as well, because there is a black hole. Some people would say that that's a net neutral and not an increase in defense spending, right? Increase in defense spending is we're going to increase it by $16 billion. It's not we're going to increase spending by $16 billion, but we have to close the $16 billion hole, billion pound hole in the budget. Talk to us about where the review is and what are some of the salient features of it going to be.
Okay, first thing to remember, it's an integrated defense, security, foreign policy, and aid review. So it's the document that will be published this week is going to be very light on detail, and it's going to be much more about Britain's position or lack of in the world, and much less about individual bits of kit. But there will then follow from that what's called a command white paper, which is more of the grisly detail, although we never publish as much detail in the UK as almost any other democracy does, and particularly that you do in the US with the Green Book, and that France does with the Loi de Programmation, or indeed Italy or Germany, which is shameful, but we're really bad on that. But, there's been, as you would expect, a fair amount of newspaper reporting about this in the last couple of days, I think because they're trying to roll the pitch. And it's very, very apparent that the major casualty is going to be the British Army, and particularly the British Army's current equipment holdings. The majority of the new cash is going to go, in fact, it's going to go into nuclear. It's going to go into submarines and the deterrent and everything about that, because that is the area that is most expensive. But it will also go into new Navy warships. And the press headlines, though, will say lots of money being spent on cyber, artificial intelligence, space. Problem is, all of those are really cheap. You could spend $1 billion on cyber and you would achieve a pretty much world-leading capability. You spend $1 billion on nuclear submarines and it just vanishes in yet another dock somewhere. There's going to be a mismatch between the headlines and the reality. Reality, heavy metal, generally heavy metal that floats or deliberately sinks. And the army is really being punished for two things. Firstly, that even at a time of high unemployment, it seems incapable of recruiting. Heaven alone knows why. The offer is clearly not good enough. And secondly, that the army for the whole of my career as a reservist in it has not looked after its equipment properly. It buys brand new shiny equipment, runs it around training area, takes on operations, then puts it away in a large hangar to rot for a while, and expresses surprise at about the 20-year mark that that piece of equipment doesn't work anymore. Well, of course it doesn't. You didn't look after it. You know, the Navy or the Air Force does a series of upgrades, midlife updates, which tend to be bigger, refits and so forth, with the result that when an Air Force aircraft leaves service, it is the most capable it's ever been, pretty much the same for a warship, actually. An Army tank or, you know, infantry fighting vehicle that leaves service was not capable of doing the job for the previous 10 years. It's shameful. But, you know, there are defense reviews going to recognize that.
What about the unusual dichotomy of we have a black hole, we're increasing defense spending? How much in real terms is defense spending actually going to be going up if you have a black hole that you're trying to plug, right? I mean,
well, that's not an unusual that's not an unusual dichotomy. That's been the state of British defense policy for 50 years, Falco, and you know that. There's always black hole. The only question is what color of black and how big. You know, the defense budget is going up at least in line with inflation. And remember, inflation is starting to rise at the moment. And we're spending at least 2% of GDP. The 16 billion covers some of that black hole and ensures that it's probably going to rise a bit more than that in, for the next couple of years. It will be very interesting to see what the timing of the spending of that 16 billion is. I don't think we'll get that this week. We might get that in the next few weeks.
But you think that it's going to be a net positive, not a net negative, right? I mean, this isn't a cut masquerading as an increase.
Look, there are going to be cuts to force structure. The British Army is going to come out of this smaller. Absolutely, right. It is. But that is an issue of policy and an issue of the fact that, alas, the Army has mismanaged itself into that particular hole.
And what about the F-35, right? I mean, there's a lot of news flow here. Before we go, I've got to run this by Ron and Richard as well. Obviously, the unions have gotten involved in the United States in the wake of comments from the House Armed Services Committee Chairman Adam Smith, the Chief of Staff of the United States Air Force, and the Air Combat Command Commander about it. All are saying that we are going to likely continue to buy the airplane, but at some point, likely sooner than later, need to start investing in another platform. That sparked a different debate. There was an interesting New York Times editorial on that, in fact, right? I mean, we've invested so much in this, we might as well recoup something as we transition to the next generation. I think there are a whole bunch of messaging issues with the airplane as well. The airplane is vastly more capable than an F-16. It is a stealthy airplane. It is going to cost more to operate on a per flying hour basis. But at the end of the day, where do you think the F-35 falls from a UK context, and what is the additional fallout you're hearing from British officials?
The F-35 is the same here as it is with you. It's too expensive. It's too expensive to operate. It hasn't been what was promised. The most interesting thing to come out of this review, therefore, will be the position of the F-35 compared to the position of Tempest. You in the state in the US have got options for NGAD. You've got options for 4.5 generation fighters. In the UK, we've got the option for Tempest. My bet will be that the money will go on Tempest and that the F-35 will be capped at, I don't know, 50 aircraft. Effectively, it will become a niche capability essentially for the aircraft carriers. And, you know, there's a bit of sort of training involved to get the Air Force used to a next generation or next but one generation aircraft. But it's too expensive, and the economic or the politico-economic benefits are just not worth it to the UK. And in that respect, thank you very much for undermining the case for the F-35, which is what the US has done spectacularly successfully for the last 6 weeks.
It's really extraordinary. Although I have to say, cost per flying hour is about a third more than an F-16. You get a lot more capability out of it. And at the same time, the production costs do continue to decline. Although the broader issue is the remaining challenges that the airplane still has, which, of course, Lockheed and the program office would say, well, I mean, guys, we're working these problems really, really hard. Ron, more broadly, and then I'm going to have Richard, you cap this. It has been an interesting week for defense spending. We've been reporting on the program on the Washington Roundtable for some weeks. The number is going to be $738 billion overall, $704 to $708 for the defense side of that number. Obviously, Department of Energy and Nuclear Modernization makes up that other bit of the delta and some other bits and bobs here across government. What's the Wall Street take? Is there what's the evolution on thinking on F-35, the future of defense spending, and how it's going to impact the group?
Yeah, good question, Margo. When you think about F-35 and you compare and just looking purely at what the market's doing, Lockheed has underperformed the other defense stock. So even though there hasn't been a lot of incoming calls from investors on the F-35, I think you're seeing some of those headlines reflect in Lockheed's market performance. The second question around the budget levels, if the budget levels indeed do come in at those levels, I think that'll be a surprise. I think there was a view there that the budget had a risk of declining materially under the new administration, particularly in face of all the deficit spending that has been done and will be done around stimulus that could put the defense budget at meaningful risk. And if we were to see a budget that's roughly flat, I think that'll be a pleasant surprise. So that's my sense where investors are.
Richard, your sense on where the program is, where it's going, and what are the implications? And if you want to talk more broadly, right, I mean, across defense, because I mean, the big question is the administration is indicating it's time for tough choices, right? That we're going to have to move some major needles if we're going to keep deterring China. Admiral Phil Davidson, the Indo-Pacific commander, said, look, we've got about a 6-year window if we're going to deter China from moving on Taiwan in terms of capability changes. And this administration seems to be very, very focused on at least driving some of those changes. But each one of these will require some degree of political pain, right, in order to try to get there. Sort of give us your sort of macro sense, not just on F-35, but sort of more broadly where you think we're headed.
You know, first of all, I think it's adorable that the military thinks it's in charge of these things. I mean, how to put this gently, you know, I mean, this is a program with a massive industrial and political constituency. And we've gone through year after year of Congress people saying, this is a monster. I can't believe it. I can't believe we're doing this. I can't believe we're buying it. We're going to have no choice but to plus it up and add 8 more planes this year to the budget. That kind of track record of throwing cash at a problem, it's really tough to see it go away. Having said that, you know, Sash is right. We're starting to get to the point where maybe there is a U.S. tempest. And obviously, Britain's long-term combat aircraft planning is now affected by the availability or the acceleratability of a new plane, and maybe ours is too. That's going to be an interesting thing. But the idea that budgets over the next 3 or 4 years are going to meaningfully change in terms of, say, 50 F-35A models a year, now that's, I'm here to tell you, that just isn't going to happen. And I'll also point out that for all the gnashing of teeth about the B model, which is, of course, what they're getting over in Britain, you know, come on. I mean, the Harrier AV-8A, AV-8B was a very typically British, well, you know, we've invented something. It's really cool. It's not everything we could use. But on the other hand, we've done something impressive. And that's exactly what it was. It could fly a little bit faster than a business jet. It didn't really have a radar from the outset. And it's a fighter, Jim, but not as we know it. The F-35B, for all its flaws, is a fighter jet. It has a really good radar. It has a really great mission equipment package in general. It can do Mach 1.4 in the B model. You know, it's a fighter jet. They can launch it from their carriers. Yes, you're going to pay more for that. And, you know, arguably, it's actually, given a should cost relative level of capability to the original Harrier, maybe it should even cost more. I mean, so I'm a little baffled by this debate and why we're having it. And to me, it's just a function of how quickly the military can aggressively ramp up its funding for an alternative and how quickly it can garner an industrial constituency for that alternative. It's one thing to have, you know, NGAD or Gen 4.5 or whatever. That's another thing to say the usual, hey, Congress people, you should like this because it's going to be built here, 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 and here. And therefore, you can wean yourself off this F-35, funding addiction.
Hey, well, as we've said on the program for a long time, right, NGAD will be a different airplane, right? Likely something bigger, something better suited for the Pacific, which may not be necessary for the kind of tactical uses that we, you know, tactical operations that we use our combat aircraft for. I mean, I think the whole notion of a non-stealthy airplane is problematic in a world with triple-digit SAMs being exported, right? I mean, so the whole you can get away with non-stealthy airplanes in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, but as soon as Russians put an S-400 or a triple-digit SAM in, it's a different ball game. Guys, thanks very much. Very quickly, you guys want to wish a happy birthday to Al Jaffe of Mad Magazine. I know that for Ron, Richard, and I, that was a meaningful part of our childhood. So happy birthday, Al. Well done. Many happy returns.
Absolutely.
Couldn't agree more.
Everybody, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it and look forward to having you back on again next week. Have a good day and a great week. See you next week.
Great to be here, Vago. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you, Vago. Okay.
Always a great time. Thanks, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.